engineers are smart people. Like they're doing those technical things for a reason, but they haven't communicated necessarily why. And if you talk to them, you can start to peel back like what they had in mind and what the benefit was from it. But and then you can start shifting the team to looking at user stories and becoming more like user focused and value focused.
What is up? Rob Irwin here with Designing in the Wild. I'm your host, as always, and we are back with another episode. I am super excited for our guest today, Sam Feller. He is a mechanical engineer and has risen the ranks all the way up through Amazon and beyond. Right now, he is working with Tulip Interfaces, and we'll get into a little bit about that later. So Sam, welcome to the show. Appreciate your time to chat with us.
Hey, dude. I'm very excited to be here. No, I've been looking forward to this all week.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, me too. Me too. So, okay, so you're a mechanical engineer. You've dabbled in web development, electrical engineering, embedded C, a little graphic design. Sounds like you've got some current passions right now around systems design. And, of course, we'll get into that. Did I miss anything?
Maybe some marketing, general entrepreneurship, bad industrial designer.
Yeah. I mean, attest to that. No, just kidding.
Mechanical. Yeah, it's true. Mechanical engineer by schooling, but I've done a lot since then. So.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
There's still an engineer on the inside. If you peel back the layers of the onion, there's an engineer on the inside.
I love it. So let's peel back those layers for a minute, Sam. Can you take us back for a minute? Drop us a bio on you and a brief background.
Let's come back to this, but I want to tell you about the time that the engineer inside of me, I don't want to say died, but when I realized I wasn't an engineer anymore, but we'll get back to that.
Excellent. I love it.
So I started off at MIT Lincoln Laboratory doing like aerospace defense stuff. And I was there for several years. I went to private industry doing like consulting mechanical work. And the consulting was a weird experience because I was being paid full time and I wasn't responsible for pulling clients in, but I was billing to overhead for 85% of my time over like 3 years. It was just totally bizarre. And I used all that time to just like dabble. And I just got into all sorts of stuff. So that led to like the electrical work, PCB work. I launched some Kickstarters. Yep. I don't know, a whole host of stuff. And I was around a lot of smart people, and tried to pick their brains and learn from them. And so eventually I ended up getting into some entrepreneurship and launching a company that made solar powered cell phone charging kiosks. And when you do that, like, you end up doing a little bit of everything when you start a company. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of a growth opportunity, led a small team, and the company went under, which is okay. That happens. And I freelanced for a while, and I ended up at Amazon as a mechanical engineer. And as you know, our group was very, very quickly growing, and I did very little mechanical work. I did mostly electrical work, and then it grew into systems work, and then I became a program manager as our team, I think we quadrupled in size. And from there, I went to Alexa, where I was a program manager for a software team, and then I left Amazon to start another venture, which very, very quickly failed, which is okay. I learned from the experience. And now I'm a product manager at Tulip. So that's my career arc in like 3 minutes there.
I love it. No, it's quite the span, I must say. And so I want to go. Can we dive in just for a minute on the Kickstarter? I'm curious to hear about your experience on that project. And did this have any? You didn't mention Awkward Engineer, I don't think. This have anything to do with that? The beginning of that as well.
No, that was through Awkward Engineer. It wasn't the first Awkward Engineer product, but it was my most successful Kickstarter. I also had a Kickstarter for a product called the Cookie Dunk Cup, and people called it. Someone on the internet called it the first worldest of first world solutions, that sometimes you're drinking a glass of milk and then you drink some of the milk out of it, and then it's hard to reach to the bottom to dunk the cookie.
And it's terribly difficult.
It's painful. Yeah. So I launched a Kickstarter for it, and the Kickstarter failed. But as a result of the campaign, someone had this, he called it like the dunker spoon. It was like this wand that fit inside the groove of the Oreo, and you could lower your Oreo into your glass of milk, like completely submerge it without getting your fingers wet. And he wanted to like expand his cookie dunking empire. And so he licensed the rights to the cookie dunk cup from me. And I think you can still buy it. I think it's called the Dunker Cup. Like D-U-N-K-R.
The dynamic duo product package.
Yeah. So that was the first Kickstarter. And I don't know. I think I raised like $7,000 out of a much larger goal that I needed to pay for injection molded tooling. And like, I think a lot of that came from my like family. And I was like, mom will donate to my Kickstarter campaign. Like, okay, that's
nice.
That's good.
Yeah. You branch out to the friends and family, like in the ring one of the many rings of your friendship and community. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'd started awkwardengineer.com to like pursue some product ideas. And I think my first one was called the Panic Button Light Switch Kit. And I just thought it was fun pressing big red e-stop buttons. And I ended up selling a whole bunch to thinkgeek.com, which was awesome.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. And ThinkGeek is entirely online, so the packaging was just this like simple like brown craft paper box. Like, it was nothing special. But then I was like, why not try retail? And so I got into like retail package design, and I sold like, I got like test runs in like Urban Outfitters and a couple other places, which was like cool to walk into a store and see my stuff like on the wall. But it didn't really.
So how did you, well, that's crazy. That's some insane exposure, by the way, to get shelving space at an Urban Outfitters. So now I'm thinking like maybe a listener or something, and I'm a product designer and I want to get this thing on a Urban Outfitters shelf. How the heck did you go about that? Was it just like serendipitous interactions or networking?
It was cold calling product buyers. It was brutal.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think that's like a normal industry trend, but that was one of the fun things about ThinkGeek, was that they were so different than other places, and they were like a younger, much faster company. And so I got a hold of a product buyer, and I was like, here's this thing. And he was like, well, there's a story about like an independent, like entrepreneurial, like designer who made this on their own. Like, packaging is done in the US, like doing as much in the US as possible. And for whatever reason, that like caught his eye, and he sold it. And I was like, okay, this is awesome. I don't know. I don't think that's a typical channel. I think people often go through like trade shows, and then the licensing industry around toys is a whole nother thing. And then I actually met a guy who did really well. He stopped doing like individual products, and he would come with like full planograms, like the whole, he'd be like, this is the section of the aisle in the store, and here's the full product line. And he would design things that way, and he was really successful with it.
Interesting. Yeah. Fitting it into the whole planogram thing, it creates not only thematic elements, but you can position things in certain ways that make them pop a little more, I guess.
Yeah. And products, I mean, individual products can be hit or miss, but when he was looking at like market needs and market trends, and he was designing like full planogram sections that would address like a full market segment, maybe within that planogram layout, like individual products would do well or not so well, but overall, like, it was successful.
And got it.
It worked out very well for him. I think he had a licensing model where he would essentially pitch these companies, and he was like, I'll develop the whole thing like turnkey, I just want like a 2% royalty for life. And enough 2% royalties for life, like they add up over a 20-year career, and he did really well.
For sure.
But I think he did a bunch of work for I think he did a bunch of work for Fiskars, like doing cutting stuff, or maybe it was a competitor to Fiskars, I'm not sure. And then he did a bunch of things that you might have seen at like Joann Fabrics, like little craft things for kids, stuff like that.
Got it. So when we were at Amazon, you came in as a mechanical engineer and quickly rose the ranks. I know we had a lot of need for a lot of people all at once, and you wore a lot of hats and jumped, you said, on the electrical engineering train for a bit, and then rose to
Do we tell the audience yeah, that sure. We work together at Amazon? Is that relevant? Yeah, do they know that?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Sam and I, little background for the listeners. Sam and I practically worked. We called it the mega room. It was like the room where all the desks and all the engineers and EEs and software firmware, we were all together. It was a ton of fun. It was very. I think that space, and you know, you could speak to this too, Sam. But to me, that space really, of all the spaces in the where we worked, the building, because it created a really serendipitous interactivity between us to kind of help us move fast, think big together.
Was that your take
too? Yeah.
I mean, it was nice being able to like see everybody there. Like we had no cube walls. You could literally see across the room.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. No one to come, kind of, you know, jump over and pop over and say hi or bother you or drop you with some weird question or something.
Yeah.
And, no, it was good. And so you went through and, you got the senior TPM, status. And, you know, I think this is where, from where I'm sitting, and correct me if I'm wrong, you really started thinking about the nuances of product development across the team. And you were developing kind of some, I don't know if the planograms, but developing a schedule and timeline. Can you elaborate on kind of that process that you started to work on?
Yeah, I can talk a bit about TPM? That. I think I had some things that sort of clicked for me towards the end of the experience. Like when I started, there were 15 people in the group and there were only 5 mechanical engineers. And by the time I left, like maybe a year and a half later, I think we were at 30 plus on the hardware half. So between like mechanical, electrical, firmware, optics, industrial design, God, did I forget any engineering disciplines that were connected to hardware. I think there were like 30 plus people. And I'd driven products to the finish line before, and I don't know if you call it like instincts to or nose for the goal line, but it took me a little while to figure out how to leverage some of those skills and build things and design systems for larger groups of people to work. And I think what I settled on was as fast as we were moving, it was impossible to plan like individual little tasks, but you still needed to coordinate across people and get things done. Yep. And I guess what I'd been taught earlier in my career and hadn't like really learned how to like click and leverage across those larger groups is an expression is how late do you want to find out that you're late? Like you're looking for usually binary, inarguable physical things that say like it's done or it's not.
Right.
Like people love saying like what percentage complete are you? And I find that's relatively useless. Like you're looking for end deliverables. And so I ended up asking like what do I get and when do I get it? And it gets you a clear answer. And so what you might need is like a physical, like say you have a physical module and the module has like a PCB inside it and it's got a like a wire harnessing and all sorts of stuff like that. And you say like are we on track to have the module? And this is where you need to start talking about deliverables and things. Like the thing is I need a demonstration of the module that it works on this date. I need you to power it on, light it up, show me that the inputs go in and out on this date. Are we going to have that? And then people say like, no, like we're not going to have that. And then you start saying why. And so you can kind of peel back the, I love product breakdown structures, like what are the components of the thing? Because when you start looking for things and deliverables, you start getting to those like inarguable, like binary, it's done or not.
Right.
And so if you have like housings as part of that module, then you can start saying like, when is the 3D print file? When is the CAD file released to the vendor? Like it's either released to the vendor or it's not released to the vendor.
Yeah.
And so starting to look for those things as part of my practice. And it was never taught to me formally at school. And I picked it up along the way. I never took the formal training for the project manager certification. Think of the name, project management professional, a PMP.
Mm-hmm.
But I did read some class material and books and prep classes for it, and the program management body of knowledge, or the PMBOK, which is, I do not recommend that book at all.
It's a good bedtime book, right? Puts you right to sleep.
Ugh, yeah. So, and it doesn't talk about getting people to work in that way. Or that practice.
So, are you bringing up? Correct me if I'm wrong here. So, I know you were starting to get big into Scrum work, and Scrum
yeah.
teams and Scrum kind of cycles. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So after I was a program manager at, the firmware team at Amazon Go with you, we implemented a Scrum process.
Okay.
And it was really cool watching us like transition from technical tasks. And then one day, I'll think of his name, Ryan.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what his name is, but he was like, I want to write stories for users. Like, I want to know why I'm writing code. And so then we started talking about like things we were doing with the circuit board and different end users of the circuit board. And we talked about like the manufacturing engineer Joe, and this poor guy had to like flash the circuit board with a test program, go through all the tests, and then he had to flash all the circuit boards again with like the final program that was actually going to run on the PCB when it was installed in the device. And we were like, why do we need to do that? That should be one program.
Yeah.
That happens to have a test mode. And so then we'd start writing stories that said, like, as a manufacturing engineer, I want like one image to install so I don't have to shoot myself in the head.
Because it's not like you're doing one of these, right? It's like, yeah, it's going to be a very repetitive task over and over. Yeah.
And so, I mean, that firmware team, I think engineers, when you let them run free, just tend to focus on the technical problems right in front of them. And they're not wrong for focusing on the technical problems. And often, like, engineers are smart people. Like, they're doing those technical things for a reason, but they haven't communicated necessarily why. And if you talk to them, you can start to peel back, like, what they had in mind and what the benefit was from it. And then you can start shifting the team to looking at user stories and becoming more like user focused and value focused. So I absolutely saw the same thing at Alexa when I worked on software teams over there. And it was definitely tough because they were back end developers, like very little front end programming there.
Sure.
And it's easy to write stories when you say like, as a user, I want to be able to click a button to do, I don't know, buy tickets. Like that's very feature focused. And we started to look, I really love user story mapping.
Yes.
And
I was gonna
mapping
bring that
out
up.
Like
Absolutely.
The user journey. Yeah. Mapping out the journey, like from one, you know, where when a user first begins with the product to like achieving the goal or the outcome that they want. And with a lot of the back-end software systems, you could start looking at your back-end service as this pipeline of like messages or things that come in and then get transformed into whatever else you need. And then learn to start writing user stories that would say things like when situation need this outcome so that you can, or need this feature so you can achieve this outcome. And what's cool is that works for like super technical back-end user stories. So like when I receive an ACH wire transfer, like that comes in over Ethernet, and I'm just making up stuff now to try and keep it non-technical.
Sure, sure.
But when I get this message, then I need to use this encoding scheme to maintain security. And it's hard to find like a good user story that says like, as a back-end computer system, like
right.
They're not, yeah, like, but when you start writing stories, like when in this situation, I want this to happen. And so I'm now at Tulip and started working with the engineering teams there.
So real quick, Sam, sorry to interrupt. What you're saying is, you know, you're essentially drafting up a user benefit statement, you know, a value proposition on the storytelling aspect of the back-end technical stuff.
And
I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
Totally rad.
And it works. And it works. And what's awesome is that usually you can end up with a story that's like readable in plain English,
yes.
Which helps me as a product manager have like, I'm product managing, like at Alexa, I was a program manager for 30 engineers. And it's just so much like technical detail.
Yeah.
Like there's no way
Death
I can
by
be
documentation
that deep on
there.
That many things. Yeah. But when you put it in like plain English, it makes it way easier for me to like come up to speed quickly, like help bring context, have a reasonable discussion about it, talk about how we're achieving value and like why we're doing things. And so, yeah, I lost my steam there. But I think I was saying I got to Tulip.
It's good because we started out with talking about Scrum work, and then we started to dive into the user journey there. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So Tulip, very like engineering heavy culture, a lot of MIT engineers like who were there very early on.
Mm-hmm.
And so similar situation where you see a lot of very like engineering heavy stories that are very like task or activity or technically focused. And it takes some training and like teaching and coaching, but like I'm now shaping up these teams to focus on user value, and it's awesome. And I've seen engineers like unleash their creativity,
yeah,
because we had a different discussion about context. Like an example problem, I remember I was helping an engineer refine a story, and he had this like super technical task about like multiple runtime environments conflicting with each other when running on this Linux device, and it, like super confusing. And in plain English, what happens is that there are different systems that could potentially conflict with each other.
Right.
So when a new user is booting up the system for the first time and setting it up for their use case, we need a way to guide them to choose the right runtimes. That's like I hope that was pretty plain English,
yeah,
and you followed me there.
Yep.
And so the engineers shifted from like trying to figure out how to deconflict these like multiple runtimes, which is insanely complicated technical solution, to realizing that they could solve the problem with just like a guided splash screen that would say like, hey, if you're trying to like make machine measurements, like click this button.
Right.
And if you're trying to like record operator clicks, press this button instead. And that was a solution that we could implement in like 2 days, as opposed to the runtime deconflicting technical thing, which could have been like a 5-week project.
That's awesome. Yeah. So like actually engaging with the user to make the decision for us, as opposed to running some sort of like savant coding in the background,
yeah,
to just do it. Yeah. Try to figure it,
yeah,
out at least.
But it also took it wasn't me that came up with that. It was like talking with the engineer to be like, what's the problem you're really trying to solve?
Right.
And then backing that out and then being like, this is the problem space. And then the engineers went nuts on it, which was like, that's just a win-win for everybody in my book. Like I'm pumped.
I love it. No, that's just a great example of, you know, I think as industrial designers, we naturally start with the user, consumer, end user, whatnot. And I think the big takeaway from an industrial design perspective for me is when I started with Amazon, you know, it took a long time for me to ramp up to have a conversation that was beneficial for both of us, me and the engineers, because I'm coming from the user, right? I've got all this provenance and historical knowledge of how people want to interface with this thing. And they're coming from the internal functional aspects of how this thing needs to work. And,
yep,
you know, being able to have a conversation about the through line between those two is super beneficial within an organization. And I could just say just a side note for any listeners out there as an industrial designer, it takes time to develop these relationships. So don't get frustrated. And also, always ask questions with these guys because, as you said, they're super intelligent, super smart people. And, you know, you guys are actually going to end up benefiting each other, being able to work faster, produce products faster and more efficiently together as these conversations about the user and the problems to be solved together as they unfold. So, yep. I mean, has that been your takeaway as well? I mean, I know we work together a little bit, and you already have a background in the user side.
I mean, I'm working with a lot more web designers these days, and especially because I have like a design sensibility, and I'm like a bad web designer. Like in a pinch, like I can do web design ish. Ugh.
Yeah,
you can hear my confidence in my own web design abilities. But when I work with the web designers and talking to them, like they'll come with a mock-up and we'll talk very much about like user outcomes and how I expect like users to use a certain feature. And so there might be like a problem with the design or an interaction that doesn't make sense or something has been emphasized, and like a good I'm coming up. I have tulip examples that I think I can talk about. I'm like mentally checking in my head like what's okay. So we're going through a situation where people are like adding machines, like they're mm-hmm. monitoring like milling machines or lathes or whatever it is.
Sure.
And so we're looking at the design and like some of the features that were emphasized, and it didn't make sense to me. And I went back to the designer and I was like, let's think about how a user is actually going to go through this. Like they're going to be adding machines like a lot once when they first get set up. But then in real life, you don't have like milling machines arriving to your shop floor like every day, and you're not shipping machines away from your shop floor every day. So like the primary interaction is going to be the initial setup, and then like the secondary and follow-on interactions are going to be like revisiting this page to see what's there to like understand what's happening, and then the tertiary interactions are going to be like adding new machines and removing like existing machines. It's going to happen, but it's going to be rare. And so when I'm not designing it for them, but I'm giving them good feedback on how I expect this to be used, which helps them, like it's not my job to solve the design problem. Like it frees the designer to use their design sensibilities and come up with their own solutions, but it's me like clarifying to them what the problem actually is.
Gosh, yeah.
I think it's a good way of working.
Yeah.
Although we're in some like early phase stuff right now. And when we're at this like initial brainstorming, like kickoff phase, like it's impossible for me to not design the solution at least a little bit, at least at like a rough outline sketch. Like it's part of, I don't know. I'll ask you for your hot take. Like, I think it's part of brainstorming.
It is. I think, you know, at brainstorming phases, of course, you're diverging as far as possible. And based on the temperament of the team, you can go as blue sky as you want. However, you know, it is kind of shunned on to kind of come to a solution at brainstorming phases. However, as mm-hmm. long as you build in pressure test time, I think that you can – the benefit of doing that is obviously you can pump out a couple of concepts and test them. And and pressure test them, and then do a cycle test or an iteration, and come up with a with a better solution, right? It's, you're never going to come up with the solution in a brainstorm, right? But I think building in that test time and cycle time. So what's your take on that?
I feel like I have to sketch, like I have to brainstorm to sketch, to be able to articulate. Like it's sometimes it's hard for me to just go straight to like, these are the outcomes I'm trying to achieve with this page. Like I have to sketch to like flesh out some ideas, to look at it, to be like, this is what I'm trying to do, to be able to articulate.
Right.
I had to design it to articulate what I needed, so I could go back to someone else to say, like, this is what I was really trying to do.
Got it. Yeah. Yeah. So that paints a better picture for me. So what you're really doing is, I mean, you're still developing concepts. It's not a convergence on a solution. It's a, it's just a preponderance on an idea. I want to pull out a nugget there that kind of struck me, and that is brainstorming together and at the same time sketching together as you brainstorm and talk through things, and the power and like how powerful that is, because I can describe to you the physical form of a thing to 20 people, and if they drew my description, it would be 20 different things. Like if I just described a lamp to 20 different people, same description, it's 20 different lamps. And so I think there is a monumental power and the tool of sketching with people to come up with solutions and highlight things. Also, one last thing I'll add is it's sometimes like problems like you're trying to solve, whether it's a web layout or a flow diagram, if you will, or navigation path through a website. You have to get these things out. Like you got to throw sticky notes up everywhere. You got to move things around. You got to talk about how this connects to this, ultimately to get them to that job to be done. That is the path that you are assessing of sorts.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to hear a little bit about something that struck me earlier. You were mentioning, as a team leader now, as a manager, and developing some of these tools to use with teams. How, for instance, as a designer, as an engineer, as a creative person, are there tools that you've come across or developed that designers and engineers can leverage to kind of bring to the forefront at a faster pace the collaborative nature of a team or environment?
I don't know if this answers your question, but I'm a big fan of like cadence and rhythm and regularity. And I've learned how to drive status meetings in a different way that I like developed towards the very end of my time at Go and really like honed at Alexa. And so when you have a due date, like if you just ask someone for status, like, and just go around the room and just say like, hey, what's your status? That's basically the equivalent of asking like, how do you feel today? How do you feel today? Which I don't know. It's not like efficient.
It's like a moving target, but not very.
But I think like one of the things that I described earlier, like what is your, when I said like when I started looking for deliverables. So if you start asking for status as like a deliverable that's due by a certain date, now you can have status meetings where you get the right information across really, really quickly. So you get really fast information flow across groups of people, which I think is huge. Mm-hmm. So like I wish I could go back in time, and I don't know if I would have had it, like maybe for the pace we were going, maybe two or three times a week, but just say like, are you on track to finish this CAD model by this date? Like, are you green, yellow, or red to do that? And cause that's really the core of the issue. I'm not saying like, Rob, how are things going? I'm not saying like, how do you feel today? Like, is the work progressing smoothly? Like the real thing that mattered was, are we going to have this by this date? And then if the answer was like, no, then you'd say like, why? You'd be like, oh, this is taking longer. We're working at insano speed. We don't have enough time for anything.
Yeah.
This just changed. Like, the product manager came down and, like, we moved, like, four major subsystems and you have to redesign everything around it. Then you could be like, yeah, we are not on track to do that by that date. And then you'd be like, okay.
Yeah, and that's where you can figure, kind of either course correct or...
And now you can have a real discussion about it. So it's...
Yeah.
When you're moving that fast, you can't ask for the little steps along the way. You need to ask for, like, when will the deliverables be complete?
Yeah.
And that's the thing that matters.
Yeah.
I think some things are, like, really, really squishy and amorphous, like CAD modeling. Like, you might have, like, a master model, and then you start, like, getting into, like, major features, and then you start, like, detailing out, like, little pieces. And that, I don't even know, like, we could probably have another discussion about, like, CAD and CAD strategies.
Yeah.
Because I've seen, like, CAD training documents where they had, like, structured CAD models where... they had a very formal, like, you start with a top level master sketch,
yep.
and then you flesh out, like, big pieces, and then you start coring stuff, and then you save, like, fillets and small details for the very end. And so it's, once you start getting into some of the end stages, like, you bump something somewhere, it bumps something somewhere else. Like,
yes.
And if you're really good at the top level layout, like, you avoid some of that stuff, but there's still a degree of, like, how do you get all these pieces to fit in the puzzle? And it's very, very hard to say, like, here is the milestone where, you know, the top level sketch is done, because you might go back and, like, have to tweak it, or you might, like, and so top level sketch isn't a good deliverable. It's really the full CAD package. And when you ask about, like, the final CAD package, it lets the industrial designer or the engineer who's responsible for that use some of their, like, professional experience and judgment to make a call about whether they're on track to, like, finish by a certain date.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, it's one of the reasons why, like, Scrum and tickets can be really hard to make work for like CAD stuff. Like, just it tends to not work that way.
Yeah, we ended up using, because I remember I did use the ticketing system with just high level feature work. You know, I think to your point. I mean, when you get down to the latter end of the project and you're already defining parting lines, and there's, like, a gotcha at the 11th hour. I mean, I think
it blows up your model.
Yeah. It'll blow up the model. Right. And not only that, I mean, if it ends up being something where, the parting line had a CMF break as well. So, it could kind of drastically, turn into, like, a design intent, like, change completely, right? And so that's where you get into the level of detail where, you know, in my experience, a lot of times, because there are deliverables and there are deadlines, and not to mention, well, maybe we just ordered, I'm just saying we in the obligatory we of a team, but, like, maybe we just ordered a crap ton of raw material to produce the things, and the molds are getting, you know, in line to get cut. You know, unfortunately, sometimes the fact of the matter is, on the design side, sometimes on the engineering side, you got to give and take a little bit, because you got to drive through on those. Sometimes you got to push the yellows through the green, and make the iteration later on. You know, when you make the new thing.
Sometimes the path to green is just working really, really hard.
In the yellow the whole time.
Yeah,
100%. Yeah, that's great. So, let's see where we want to go with this. All right. So let's take a step back for a minute. I consider yourself a think big kind of person. You know, kind of always okay. having your eye at 30,000 feet, but also 3 feet, you know, into the nuances. Yeah. Do you have any, how do you get to the 30,000 foot per view, when you're coming up with ideas or trying to drive, projects and concepts?
The nicest thing that anybody said about me in like our internal reviews was like, Sam sees the forest and the trees.
Yeah.
Like, that was really nice.
That's sweet.
That was really
That's
nice.
That's sweet. Yeah. No, and it's a skill that I think a lot of people yearn to have, and maybe they have some mm-hmm. of that sometimes. I personally try to do both as well. You know, think big is obviously one of the Amazon principles, and you know, across a number of other large organizations as well. How do you think big when you're moving fast?
I've always thought in terms of systems, and like, that's very hard to articulate. Maybe early in my career, I worked, at a med device. It was the consulting firm where I was unbillable 85% of the time. And they prided themselves on like systems work. Like, a lot of their companies, maybe they had done something mechanical or electrical in the past, but now like software was going to be involved, and now there was also like a back end and a cloud as well. And now you're doing like a full systems integration. You're not just designing a mechanical component as well. And they took like a structured, rigorous approach to it. And I think it's partly because in med device, you needed to have something called like a design history file. And so you needed to show proof that you designed something like on purpose, and that there were design artifacts along the way. Like, you had certain analyses tasks completed, like testing tasks, like review tasks. Like, if you held a meeting about something, we would literally sign a sheet of paper that people like attended the meeting, and that became an artifact that you put in your design history file.
Wow.
And we would use our systems diagrams to organize the design. Like, if you think about like, we're going to be having a meeting and generating these little pieces of paper, like every time we have a meeting, you start thinking about where those little pieces of paper are going to go.
Yeah.
And so we would use our like systems diagrams to drive the product breakdown structure and the organization of our design history file. And so at the top level, you might have like your medical device, which would include like all the testing that was done at the full like device level. But then, like, I remember working on like a breathing therapy thing. It used like a therapeutic gas. So then there would be like control boards inside it, and there'd be tanks and various like electromechanical valves, and those in turn would be subsystems. And so like the test documents and test plans and requirements and meetings that existed for those subsystems would also go into like their own folder inside that. And then you could get down to like the component level, and then I don't know how you selected an oxygen sensor or CO2 sensor or nitrous gas or whatever the therapeutic mm-hmm. gas was. Like, that would also have its own folder. And so I don't know if that's like thinking big, or at least thinking about the full system.
Yeah.
But like, I came from a place where you had to think about that full system ahead of time, because if you didn't think of that full system, there was no way to get all the component pieces, not just to like literally fit together, but you needed the system to function and come together. And
yeah.
I think a lot of times when people don't have that systems mindset or systems approach, you end up with these like integration hell at the end where you're trying to get stuff to work together
yes.
and it doesn't. I'm thinking like the Obamacare website that crashed on rollout is like a classic example of
yeah.
this. And so I don't know. I've always had that big picture view. And that's helped me, like, because I've dabbled in so many things, it makes it easier to understand the little details for me. So, like, yeah, like, I can get into the details of the industrial design, or, like, PCB trace width, or, yeah. like, PCB stack up, or, I don't know, a gazillion different things.
Sure. No, that's a great kind of example. And it leads me to think through all the times I've been, you know, maybe I've consulted or been with a company, whomever and whenever that was, where the leadership didn't care to, or the client care to, pay for the thinking on the front end to save your ass on the back end ultimately.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So that whole integration hell is an effect from not thinking on the front end through kind of the techniques and processes you're going to use. And I think, you know, just taking that back just for a minute for the industrial design side of things, you know, okay, let's say I'm designing some headphones. Okay, there's, a master headphone file. And then you drill down from the component to all the way to the component and part level. However, there's also other nuances of, okay, how many iterations do I want to do? How much testing do I want to do with users? How many possible concepts do I want to come out with? You know, how long is that going to take to do? Let alone modeling the form factors, getting the, you know, the space call outs for the actual componentry inside, working with the engineer. So thinking through that through line to the end result for the product is very, very important for an industrial designer, period, and definitely something you should be thinking about coming out of school if they didn't teach you about that. I mean, bill of materials is one thing when you design a product, but to understand the time that it takes to develop the whole product end to end is very, very, very powerful.
So if you knew, like, the system isn't just like the headphones themselves, but like the system also includes all like test plans, revisions, user tests.
Right.
Like the user test, like, we talked a lot about like deliverables. The user test, in a way, like, I don't like thinking of the user test as a series of tasks, because you are going to have to test with a bunch of users.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, I want a report summarizing what you learned from those user tests. Like, everything, I need to, is it an email, a PowerPoint, I don't know, a piece of paper? Like, or is it just you telling me what you learned? Because that's okay too. But like, the day I get a PowerPoint that says, this is what we learned from the user test, that's when user testing's done. That's what I need. Like, everything,
right, it's baked.
Everything else up to them is just like noise to me, which is mean, because I love participating in user testing and watching stuff happen. But like, it's
just like, give me the analysis.
It's what gets you to focus. It's what gets you to focus on, like, that's the thing that you need as part of this system. Like, if you're putting all these pieces together, that would be a box on my systems diagram.
100%.
That PowerPoint.
100%. Well, that's some fun conversations around system design. I think, you know, personally for me, there wasn't a ton of conversation or classes or thinking around this in college. And it took me a long time, because out of college, I went ahead and just started a consultancy or, you know, a company, and had to start thinking through wearing all the hats, for the running the business. And I'm sure you've been through the same thing, but that whole systems approach of how to bring everything to either deliverable for the client or customer or whomever. It's a very important skill.
Even earlier in my career, I guess, was when I was at Lincoln Laboratory doing like aerospace defense stuff. Like, we're doing like spaceflight systems, like satellite telescopes.
Yeah.
And so like NASA basically invented like systems engineering. So that was maybe even earlier in my career, was kind of baked into me.
Wow. Yeah. So I want to shift gears a little bit, Sam, and maybe just talk a little bit more about some random thoughts you might have been having
all
around
right.
engineering, design. Do you have any non-related creative pursuits?
So I do run awkwardengineer.com, which has a blog on it.
Okay, so you write.
Do you know about my typewriter?
No.
I've got it. Not that podcast listeners can see. I'll hoist it up.
Well, we're videoing, and hopefully at some point I'll get these up on YouTube. So we'll get there.
Yeah, hold on. It's on my desk over here. But yeah, I did a lot of writing on the typewriter, at least early in COVID, as like a, called it my COVID journal. It was my like stress management. But
yeah. Oh wow, this nice. Was, dang, this, that's like what a my, early turn of the century.
So this was 1917, maybe?
Yeah.
I bought a typewriter. It was a Royal, I don't know, it's the brand on it.
Yep.
And, like, enjoyed it. And then found from, like, my great-grandfather, there was, like, a typewriter in the attic.
Oh.
And so it was the same model, but it was just in terrible condition. And there is one typewriter. There's a typewriter repair shop in New England. The guy's in Arlington.
No way.
Which is next town over from Somerville. And so I brought him this old unit, and I was like, I don't need two typewriters, but this, like, old one that's in need of significant, like, repair has sentimental value to me. And the guy was like, I'll repair it for the price of you giving me the other typewriter.
Oh, my gosh. Like,
that's totally cool.
Hell of a deal.
And so, yeah. So
it's beautiful.
I'm pretty sure he came out well on the deal.
Yeah.
But that's fine with me. I'm a happy kid. So.
Well, speaking of writing.
I do that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sketch and doodle.
Yep.
Every now and then I sketch and doodle a little. I try and, like, brush up my industrial design skills. Ugh. There's a note that says draw bigger. Yeah.
Nice.
Here, I'll hold it up to the camera where the listeners can't see. But
perfect.
So
I did. Hey, like, you got all that room on that sheet. Just get that whole arm into it. That's kind of what.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
In pre-COVID times, I do some figure drawing, which I found really relaxing. There's a place down the street from my house that did, like, figure drawing sessions that I'd go to on a semi-regular basis. I think that was a little easier to go to before kids as well. And then, I don't know, I rock climb, which is not necessarily a creative pursuit, but it's other stuff I do. And I cook. Cooking's creative.
Oh, nice. So back on the writing side of things, any from our just past conversation, any books, articles, like websites that have excited you lately that maybe the listeners might want to check out?
So I read Hacker News. That's one of the sites. I look at Core 77 regularly.
Yeah,
great site. Core. That's your audience.
Yeah, for sure.
The Swiss Miss design blog. I think it's like Swiss stat. The one's the hot chocolate, and the other is like a lady from Switzerland who lives in the U.S.
Okay.
So
that sounds like, what's the theme on that one? That sounds I don't know, hilarious or quite intriguing.
So the one. That's the hot chocolate company. That's a hot chocolate.
Right.
It's their corporate website.
Totally get it.
That's got it. It's either with a dash or without. And then the lady from Switzerland, she's, I don't know, she's a designer, and she mostly just, like, curates nice things that she finds around the internet, which I enjoy.
That's inspiring. Yeah.
I don't know. There's probably, I have like a rant in me about, like, curation is key. Like, I went through my photos for the past year. Oh, man. So we had this interior designer put together, like, a floor plan for what was going to go, like, in the living room, which I think like 90% of her job was serving as, like, a mediator between my wife and myself. We're going to have, like, a neutral third party have creative control, and we're just going to trust their judgment on this. Like, if I was in charge, you'd end up with some weird stuff. So she decided to put, like, her recommendation, we had this wall, she was like, you're gonna put a picture grid, put like 8 photos up on that wall. Like, we talked about how, like, family photos were important. And so I went through my kid is 7 now, my oldest one, so I went through 7 years of photos to find, like, the perfect 8 that I will put on the wall.
That's right.
And so
what an, like, exercise.
Sometimes you scroll through old photos on your phone, and, like, takes a lot of pictures to get one good picture. And so you have, like, 50 pictures of, like, the same thing on your phone. It's just crap. And so what I do, I I have like a backup folder in Dropbox, and I go like month by month, and I pull like the best pictures from that month. And so curation is key. And so the Swiss Miss blog,
this is
curates, which I love it. This matters to me.
This is totally like, this is an app waiting to happen to download right now. It's like, use some AI right behind pictures. That. And then, use some AI and then like choose like 15 of your 5,000 pictures that are really nice that you like. And then it just uses some like algorithm of composition and says, and it just does it for you. All right. Who's doing listeners? Let's make it happen.
Picking those 8 photos, like, it's emotional.
Yeah, it is, I'm sure. It's a machine.
I got to get you the story about when I no longer was an engineer. This is important.
Please. No rush.
So we were at Amazon. We were in the middle of a build, and someone needed to attach like some side panels to like some fairings, some covers needed to be attached to something. And it had screws. I didn't know what screws to use or where they were or what the torque spec was or how to look it up or any of that. And in that moment, I realized, I was like, I have become useless. I was like, that's when I realized I wasn't a mechanical engineer anymore. I'd become a manager in that moment.
Well, I mean, not to mention that like the information wasn't available regardless. You couldn't even turn a wrench anymore without a spec sheet.
that's when I knew I became useless. I don't know how to look up this screw. I don't know where it is. I don't know the part number for it. Like, I'm sorry.
I'm sure that was still, that's hilarious. And that's a back in the days of the wild, wild west. I mean, we were doing cycle times on that dash cart was like 6 weeks each prototype.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was wild.
But it was earlier on, like I still knew where stuff was.
Yeah.
Like I was still the one putting it together. And at some point something happened and like someone else had full responsibility for it. And I didn't know what it was anymore. And I like tried to help and I couldn't. And I was like, I'm now a manager.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's one of those things. We were moving so fast. You probably just spent a week up on your computer doing some CAD, and you came back down, and, like, there was 30 new people, and everybody had their own toolbox.
I wasn't even doing CAD, but, yeah, something happened. I don't know.
That's crazy. Well, Sam, that is a great note to leave it on. I do appreciate your time. It's always a pleasure chatting with you. And
yeah, dude.
I hope you come back on sometime.
Absolutely.
To drop me some knowledge on what you're up to here in a bit. So thanks again. Oh, by the way. Okay. So where can people find out about Tulip? Where can they check out some of your work? I know you mentioned Awkward Engineer, but go for it.
Tulip is online at tulip.co. Call it a meta tool. It's a tool for making tools for people that make stuff. So if you've ever been on a manufacturing floor and you said, I wish I had an app for that, like Tulip will let you low code, no code, et cetera, build your own apps for manufacturing specific things. So that is Tulip. And then I also run awkwardengineer.com. That's awkwardengineer.com. AWKWARD. Sometimes people have trouble with that word.
Uh-huh. It's awkward.
Yeah.
All right, Sam. Well, this has not been an awkward conversation, and I do appreciate it. Again, thanks. And this is Rob, your host, Designing in the Wild. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll check you later. See ya.
Hey, guys. Rob again. I hope you guys are enjoying these conversations. I always learn a little bit every time I do these interviews. So if you didn't catch the last episode with Kip Zoni Doyle, it's a great talk about how to protect your intellectual property as you develop new products. Also coming up after this episode next week, we will be talking with Andre Brown. He works at Amazon. He is a chief engineer for innovation over there in the transportation sector. He and I worked together a few years back when I was at Amazon, but he has some really awesome projects in the past to talk about. We also get into a little bit of conversation around biomimicry, which is always fun. And I hope you all will enjoy it. So if you want to get notified about when these guys get released, which normally is every Monday, but hit that follow button and you will automatically be notified. And also, we have our store open on our website, and this is a personally curated collection of goodies that I have used throughout the years that have been tried and true for me when it comes to creating new products and innovating in categories. And when you purchase something in our store, I've decided to donate 50% of those proceeds to a wonderful group called Operation Tiny Home. They're a 501c3 national nonprofit, and they assist people struggling with severe housing instability to maintain a life of dignity through custom high-quality tiny housing solutions, as well as empowerment training programs. This group, Operation Tiny Home, is great. They, you know, these tiny homes are the first link in a chain of services required to unlock a path back to dignity for the homeless, many of which are veterans. It's a real step in helping them get back on their feet and reintegrated into the fabric of community. Consider checking it out at theidpodcast.co. And with that, we'll see you next week.